Hello, Gemini, and welcome to Astrology Studio, The Twin Paradox. I'm Eric Francis Coppolino, your astrologer for the next hour or so, here with a look at your solar chart for 2025 and into 2026 and really beyond, because the things that happen in 2025 and 2026 are going to last a while. We carry them forward into the future, particularly the main thing that is influencing you in these coming years, which is going to be Uranus in your birth sign. Okay, so for those of you not familiar with this kind of a reading, it is a reading of your solar chart and not your natal chart. So the solar chart is what I use to write the horoscopes, Planet Waves Weekly, Planet Waves Monthly. It's what I use to write those 6,000-word readings in the annual edition, kind of creeping up there, went past 6,000 words this year. Pisces came in at 9,000 words. And so the solar chart method is a method of reading houses and planets. It does not rely on your natal chart. And it is, to me, always amazing how much information comes from astrology without the use of the natal chart. Now, I'm aware that this contradicts all of the "we must have your birth time exactly right." That is true for certain forms of consulting. It's true for horary astrology. It's true for a lot of things. But solar chart astrology pretty much emerges from astrological almanacs and popular publications. And it is one of the most underutilized tools in all of astrology, with so much emphasis placed on the natal chart, so much emphasis placed on the precision of the birth time. So what we get with the solar chart is we're working basically with a form of mundane astrology, and you can think of this chart as being the chart for your sign rather than the chart for you personally. But as it works out, when we read for your sign, we're really well over halfway there. Quite efficient, and it allows me to work with, let's say, economy of scale, but also provide you with vital information about your astrology, all of which is going to be available to be seen in this chart, your solar chart for 2025 and 2026. I've got some computer generated charts, although I prefer my calligraphy charts. Just getting the camera angle right here. I prefer my calligraphy based charts just because they're a little more beautiful, and we got some light on the subject here. They're more beautiful, and I think more personal, and I prefer to have things kind of handmade here in the digital age. But it's all in here. It's all in here. And we will go to we'll go to a couple of precise charts for events, but with this sketch, and that's what it is, it's really a sketch, I'm not using degrees or anything like that, describes all of the major activity that has been happening, all that I have been writing about for the past few years, and jumping up and down, making a big fuss about, and that includes things like Pluto entering Aquarius. It includes the Family Hunger Games, Quasar, Cupido, Ixion. That's Family Hunger Games aspect. That's a very important place in your chart. I'll go through that. This actually should be Nessus, not Chiron. Big difference. I'm not going to redo the whole chart for that, but that is Nessus. And we have Chiron showing up here with Eris here as well. And so basically it's all there. The chart presumes that you're Gemini rising because you have the sun in Gemini. So this type of reading works for Gemini sun, Gemini rising, and some people swear by their moon signs. But the important thing to know is that house number one is always a reference point. It's just the reference point where we say, okay, this is the first chapter of the chart. This is where the story of this chart begins, is in the thing that we're calling house one, which in a natal chart or a horary chart is called the sign rising. But even though technically that whole side of the zodiac is rising, the first house is usually considered the sign rising. All right, so just on a structural level, we know a couple of things right away without even getting into planets in this chart. And the first thing we know is that when you're a Gemini, your relationships are largely described by Sagittarius. And so what this is suggesting is that Gemini, which tends to be a sign that really is about immediate family and the local environment, is contrasted with Sagittarius, which tends to be about the distant environment, for example, international places, long distance travel, and also people with a viewpoint that comports with that. And one suggestion here is that in your relationships, you seek a sense of the wider world through your relationships. You want the world to be a bigger place than it normally is for you. And the way you get that is usually you get that through others. But that's not necessary. It is possible to actually live in that big world and to see the, let's say, the world itself as the environment in which you live, which means that as Gemini, you can be very comfortable in pretty much any country or any place you travel. Gemini has a wonderful ability to feel at home anywhere in the world. And that's something to remember and to keep in mind about yourself and to, you know, utilize and make the most of. And with Sagittarius on the seventh house, your relationship sign is ruled by Jupiter, which is about to be in Cancer. Your sign is ruled by Mercury. Mercury moves very, very quickly throughout the year. Mercury makes three revolutions, three orbits of the sun in the time that the Earth makes one. So its orbit of the sun is 84 days and is constantly changing. It's retrograde 25% or so of the time, and then 22, something like that. And then when you add in all the shadow phases, we're in the retrograde effect a lot of the time. And so you are therefore what would be described as mercurial, that is to say, of the nature of Mercury, and you rely upon people who vibrate a little bit slower, who are a little more, steady, who are represented by Jupiter. And people represented by Jupiter take 12 years to go around the sun versus 84 days to go around the sun. That's a pretty big contrast. I haven't studied the other planets for that, but I mean, with, for example, Scorpio and Taurus, Venus goes around the sun in about 200 days, more or less, and Mars goes around the sun in about 2 years. That's pretty similar. And so one thing about Gemini is that you are inclined to take an interest in partners who can be quite different from who you are, with a different orientation, a different perspective, a different understanding of existence, and their lives can be on a very different scale than yours. I mean, Jupiter is 1,200 times the size of the Earth, and therefore probably like 2,000 times the size of Mercury at least. So that's a pretty vast difference in scale. And one thing this suggests is that the movements of Jupiter affect not only your relationships, but they describe your environment generally. So we'll come back to that in a second. The big news in your chart is that Uranus is entering Gemini in July, and it does so. I've got the chart for that cast. I meant to look up the second time that Uranus enters. Outer planets usually make two ingresses into signs. Come on, grr. All right, we're going to have to wait on that. I will. I will add the date that apparently the battery's dead. The date that that Uranus enters Gemini for the second time. That's likely to be in early 2026. But suffice it to say that this is happening, and it is happening. Certainly, your adult lifetime, there's not that many 84-year-olds who are watching this video. So suffice it to say, for nearly everyone, this is a first-in-a-lifetime experience and a once-in-a-lifetime experience to be having this planet that has it is the weirdest of all of the planets. Uranus is the weirdest of all the planets. It was discovered in the late 18th century. I can never get the dates straight. I think 1781 or something like that. And it is concurrent with the initial harnessing of electricity. You think of Ben Franklin as an old guy flying his kite, right? They're starting to get concepts of electricity. Franklin, by the way, being the first electrician, the first electrical engineer, kind of incredibly. Uranus is the revolutionary planet. It is always, pretty much always around anytime there is some type of revolutionary activity, when there are in moments of radical change. Now, Uranus is always somewhere, and what I mean by it's always around is I mean that when there's an event or a series of events that are about radical, spontaneous, revolutionary change, you will often find Uranus nestled right into the aspect pattern, if not leading the show. Uranus is also about inventions. It has a lot to do with applied science, not theoretical science, not corporate science, but rather applied science. Think of Benjamin Franklin in his workshop, you know, inventing batteries for the first time, inventing electrical batteries for the first time. That's the kind of thing that you get with Uranus. So it's got a lot to do with electricity, with revolutions, with inventions, and with precipitous changes. And it is going to be entering your sign, and it is going to be kind of, in a way, dominating your life for the next 7 years. Now, people who know some astrology might say, well, how do you know that a planet, you know, crossing the first degree of a sign cusp means anything at all? Like, how do you know it means anything? Well, I know from having watched dozens of these kinds of changes over the years, saying from minor planets, major planets, including sign changes of Uranus, of Pluto, of Neptune, of Jupiter, and it is true that the first degree of the sign is highly sensitive for the entire sign. So even if your sun is way back at the end of Gemini, Uranus entering Gemini is going to have an influence on you. The entire energy field, quote unquote energy field, it's all symbolic. The entire energy field is sensitive to the ingress of a planet into a sign. When astrology is conducted honestly, when we actually are interested in how it's not only what's happening, but how it's happening, it works out over and over again that there are far more questions raised by astrology than there are answers. But I do my best to offer you coherent reading, so let's see if I can keep doing that. So the best modern interpretation of Uranus comes from Rick Tarnas. Rick Tarnas wrote a book that I should keep on my desk so I can hold it up, and you'll be very impressed, called Cosmos and Psyche. I was a member of the unofficial committee who waited for this book to come out for 10 or 15 years, and finally one day, around 2000, 1999, Cosmos and Psyche comes out. But before Rick Tarnas wrote Cosmos and Psyche, he wrote a book called Prometheus the Awakener. And his theory in that book is that the planet Uranus, who was named for the overthrown Titan god, the previous generation of gods, overthrown by the generation that comprised entities like Jupiter and Saturn, was actually misnamed and that the proper name for this thing would have been Prometheus. He said, because the properties of Uranus are a lot more Promethean than they are Uranian. And furthermore, Uranus, the god Uranus, was the god overthrown, where the in actual fact, planet Uranus, as we see it manifest, does a lot of overthrowing and is rarely ever overthrown. It is the original revolutionary. But in terms of the Prometheus theory, Prometheus being the lesser immortal god who stole fire from the gods, stole with the help of Athena, steals the fire of the gods and gives it to humanity. So what is this fire of the gods that is being given to humanity? Well, we could say the fire of the gods is technology. We could say the fire, well, it's going to be some form of technology. I also think of it as being the flame of the human spirit, the thing about humans that is inherently inventive and seeks to claim for itself the power of the gods. And so there is a bit of thievery involved in Uranus, who's kind of an outlaw, though aided and abetted by Pallas, who, you know, Pallas Athene, their names used interchangeably, who is the goddess of law. So it would be interesting that the goddess of law, is my understanding of the myth, assists Prometheus in stealing the fire from the gods. And this, of course, comes with all forms of hubris. It comes with all problems that that exist in the human realm because, well, we're not really supposed to have nuclear power and micro computing capacity and the, you know, the ability to like do a TV show, you know, right from your home office. And so there is that element as well. But getting away from any judgments on this, you are being bestowed with in a sense this power of the fire of the gods, and so this is a great moment for you because you are going to have much more influence, much more power than you're accustomed to having as an ordinary mortal. Now, what Uranus also does is it serves as a kind of a liberating influence. It frees you from past constraints. It frees you from what you, you know, thought was true in the past, what you were absolutely certain and knew was true in the past. Uranus brings a kind of a liberation from the constraints of history. It brings on, it facilitates genuine freedom from what, you know, what you thought you knew. So Uranus requires an open mind as one of its most important, safe use techniques. Uranus benefits from having an open mind and people around it who, you know, who are open-minded. And so, you know, keep that in mind, in your open mind, as you, you know, go through the inevitable changes that this is going to be about. Now, what kind of changes? Well, it's mostly going to be changes to you. That any changes in the outer world are very likely to be precipitated by internal evolution, internal movements, internal changes within yourself that are about basically you not only growing, but also catching up with yourself. So that if things seem like they're changing very fast, a lot of that has to do with you catching up with yourself. And that means catching up with yourself after, you know, for example, 7 years of Uranus in Taurus. So what that looked like was, here's Taurus. It's your 12th place. 12th place is the first place. And the 12th place can be concealed. I mean, that's one of the main key notes of the 12th place, is that it's hidden. You don't really know exactly what is going on in there. This is an interesting placement to have, and in a way, it you know, Taurus is the most physical of the signs, and what Taurus in the 12th describes is an almost an ethereal quality of who you are, a mental quality as opposed to a physical quality. I'm not saying there are not Geminis who can't run a very, very fast marathon. I'm just saying that part of what makes Gemini so ethereal and so giving you so much dexterity in the verbal realm and in the mental realm is that the physical realm is a little bit out of the way. And this suggests you have to pay special attention to the physical realm. And it's possible that the last 7 years from when Uranus arrived here in 2018 and it's now leaving in 2025, 2026, so that span of roughly 7 years, your body's been under a lot of pressure. That is manifested as psychic pressure. And I think that if I were experiencing Uranus moving through my 12th house in Taurus, by this time I would be ready to bust out and set myself free. I would be ready to do something different and not to feel so confined. And the 12th house is definitely about confinement. It's a house associated with prisons, for example. And Uranus just wants to break free of all bonds and all constraints. And thankfully, that is what is happening. And so, take it slow. If you're a bit dehydrated, you don't want to drink like a gallon of water when you sit down to drink. And I think that if you've felt constrained or in some way, bound to your home or bound by circumstances that you didn't fully understand and maybe didn't have control over, allow your newfound freedom to kind of commence in incremental steps. Take some steps rather than cutting loose all at once. Of course, you may decide that you're gonna book an around the world airplane tour and hit 5 cities in 3 weeks. But that'll get you somewhere, but not as far as doing what you'd much rather do, which is stay in one place, one exotic place for a while, and not constantly be jumping around. Okay, so Uranus is here to set you free. And Uranus is here to give you a concept of freedom, a self-concept of freedom, and also to help you identify with that so that you're going to shift your orientation from being a person who largely had defined yourself by being confined to someone who defines yourself by being free. Now, one interesting thing going on is that Sedna entered Gemini last year. It had been in Taurus all since the 1960s. I think Sedna goes into Gemini something like 1966 or 1967. So I've been jokingly saying, well, the 60s are finally over because Sedna changed signs and entered Gemini. Well, really, Sedna in Taurus was the last big holdout of the 1960s. Now, Sedna takes, I think the current calculation of the orbit is something like 11,600 years. Let's see, 11,400 years. Eris has an orbit of only approximately 550 years and is somehow more powerful than Sedna. But the thing about Sedna is we don't really understand Sedna very well. And my analysis of Sedna is that it is so deep that it defines the environment that is that's kind of behind and beyond everything that you can't really see unless you look at it with special with special tools. One thing that we can say about Sedna in Taurus is that it has brought on an astounding age of materialism, that uh, that you know, since the 1950s and the 1960s, really when Sedna settles into to Taurus, there is this almost doubling every year of materialistic obsession going on. And so that was a defining feature of the entire Sedna in Taurus era. The other thing about Sedna in Taurus is that many people have begun associating it with the ice caps melting, with the Arctic and Antarctic ice melting. And in fact, Sedna is the story of the Inuit creation goddess who feeds humanity, who makes sure that people actually have enough to eat by creating all the sea creatures that humans eat. And it was named Sedna by Mike Brown and team because he was doing it to call attention to the problem of global warming. And so without directly associating it with global warming, which you can do, and we would really have to have a long discussion about what that term means, like what, or climate change, you know, what that term really means. I think that some of the most important elements of climate change are completely being ignored, though I'm glad to see finally someone's calling attention to microplastics. That's a very important part of climate change, is microplastics. The climate has many, many different facets. And during the whole era of Sedna in Taurus, the emphasis was all about the Earth and about peak oil and things like Earth Day and all of this. And now that Sedna has arrived in Gemini, we are seeing that the environmental emphasis of Sedna is the mental environment, the psychological environment, and more than anything, the computing environment. And so Gemini has a special role in the kind of moderation of the computing environment, as does Taurus. And I'm familiar with the history of computer science. I couldn't teach a college course on it, but I know enough to know that, you know, that between the late 1930s, around 1938, and 38, 42, let's see, we got to go back to earlier, maybe 36, Uranus enters Taurus, the computer is largely a thing that is behind the scenes, but it is very, very important. So if we're to believe the usual mythology about World War II, that there were the Nazis had a code, and the code was broken by a computer, a lot of that work preparing for that was done with Uranus and Taurus, and Sedna during World War II was back here. But let's just look at Uranus as an indicator of the computing environment. When by 1942, Uranus enters Gemini, World War II is raging, and then for the next 5 years of Uranus in Gemini, the team led by Alan Turing is working on cracking the Nazi code using a computer, and they succeed in doing so. The Enigma, the Heydrich Enigma, depending on which one we're talking about, was done under the influence of Uranus in Gemini. And so it's like all the early invention and prep work for the creation of the computer was done with Uranus and Taurus, and then when the computer breaks out and moves into the forefront, it is Uranus in Gemini. And this is also going to be true of Sedna in Gemini. Sedna in Gemini describes the influence and the impact of the total digital environment on humanity, but this is going on by way of Gemini. And so what I'm suggesting is, and I pretty much write something about this every time I open my put my pen down on the paper and I say something about it every time I open my mouth, which is that we are now pretty much becoming the products of our digital environment rather than the digital environment becoming the product of human ingenuity. We know these computers can write their own code. They can reinvent themselves. They have agendas that are not necessarily the ones that were directly programmed in, but you know, there always does seem to be someone in charge and setting the parameters for how these computing environments function. But what I'm getting at here is due to Sedna in Gemini and Uranus in Gemini, you're going to be heavily, more heavily than nearly anyone, influenced and impacted by the computing environment, now going under the false name AI or artificial intelligence. And so this story really is about you. And you know this because you've experienced your sensitivity to technology in the past. You may not like the stuff very much. You might not like to use the stuff very much, but you know how much you're influenced by it, and you also know how how integrated into the story of technological evolution that you can be. And so this is about to ramp up radically, and we're about to see a lot of effects with, Uranus will be in Gemini that were very much concealed with Uranus in Taurus, and Uranus in Taurus in your 12th house. So that is all of that stuff about your relationship to the digital environment is crucial to understanding your astrology now. And it comes out in many other ways. And I'll give one or two more examples of how it comes out, particularly up here in the 11th house. But the most important thing that you can do is to preserve your humanity. And that means understanding what your humanity is. It means that you are, if you're going to really live, you are going to have a sense of making your own choices. You're going to understand that no computer can actually make a choice for you. Although we're being told over and over again that the nature of the computing environment is all going in the direction of basically running our lives and running society. And I suggest that you resist that at every turn. I suggest that you resist it at every turn in your life, that you take a chance to resist it when it seems to be some kind of a collective or community issue, that you push back against this. And I'm not saying don't use the stuff. What I'm saying is use it in a fully conscious way, knowing exactly what it is that you want to do with it and why you need the tool of a computing device rather than the rather than some other tool that came out of the previous generation of technology. All right, so let's take a little break, and I'll be back in a digital instant with part two of this reading, wherein we're going to cover the other gas giants and ice giants. Now this software is supposed to give me the ability to pause the recording, so back in a bit. All right, continuing. So let's wrap up the ascendant portion of your chart, which I focused on a lot, but I want to just make two or three more points. Anything with Gemini is going to either bifurcate, or there are going to be two of it. Now, Geminis often have two dominant personalities. Usually they present one to each person that they know, one or the other. So most Geminis do not let you know both sides of their nature. So the other side tends to remain a mystery, and it even remains a mystery to many of you born with a strong Gemini signature in your chart. You may not be aware that there are in some way two of you who are in the world. And we can see this, by the way, it's not merely a psychological feature. When you have Saturn in Gemini, you've got, for example, very, very big news involving the Twin Towers. That was in 2001. When you're doing any form of mundane or horary astrology, where you got Gemini, when Gemini comes into the picture, you're going to see some manifestation of that dualism. But Uranus represents multiples. Uranus represents the group. It represents the many. And so when you have Uranus entering Gemini, you not only get the phenomenon of, for example, an acceleration and all of this, rapid revolutionary transformation, you also get the influx of a group or a multiplication of the number of possibilities. So keep that in mind. And this is giving you a lot of, ability for variance, for variations in who you are and how you present yourself. And there is a lovely eccentricity that comes with Uranus entering any one sign, but I think it's going to be particularly eccentric and exciting with Uranus in Gemini for you and for other people. Now, the four gas giants, they sometimes call Uranus and Neptune ice giants, but let's call them all the gas giants. Pluto, excuse me, completely different. That's an ice baby, six of them. They are Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. These four planets comprise 99% of the total planetary mass of the solar system. You get with the Earth, Venus, Mars, Mercury, the asteroids, all the centaurs, and Pluto, and all the Pluto-like planets only comprise 1% of the planetary mass of the solar system. The rest of the planetary mass comes from the four gas giants, and they are now all moving in concert. They're moving together. They're moving in concert. And this includes Uranus making its move on July 7th. You can see up there, this is my chart for the ingress. It looks like this, but I'm going to stick with my hand-drawn chart. It's much prettier. And then also, Neptune has recently entered Aries. That was a little bit earlier this spring. Saturn, next week, is about to enter Aries and begin a long conjunction of Saturn and Neptune in Aries, which goes well into February, March of 2026. It's still going to be effective well into the Northern Hemisphere spring of 2026. It begins a major, important era that we last got in the late 1980s when the last Saturn-Neptune conjunction took place. So we've got Saturn on its way into Aries. Neptune is on its way into Aries. They're both going to retrograde back and then come back in. The exact conjunction, I think, is in February of 2026. But remember that this is a before and after moment. It is a big deal, a big transition. And it's also a point of reckoning of the overall astrology of the digital age. Okay, so that's going on. So now we've accounted for all of these. And what's nice about planets in Gemini and in Aries is that they are in what is called a sextile aspect. See, I'm running a little short on pencils here. But let's draw in that aspect. And this is a harmonious aspect. And the symbol for the aspect is like that. That's called, it looks a little asterisk, and that's a sextile. And so what you're going to have is a sense of cooperation. So I have a theory that the 11th house of Gemini is a very important house. House 11. And that's Aries. See that there. And right now there are many, many planets gathered in Aries. I mean, really, it is pretty wild. There's one that I haven't talked about much called Borsisi. That's like a centaur with a B on it. That's right, hanging out right in the first degree-ish. And then Neptune and Saturn. And then also Salacia is there. I talked about that in an article last week. And then we've got the Chiron Eris conjunction going on all the way into 2026, and this is the turning of an important age. It happens so rarely that It happens maybe every three generations. The last time it happened was in was in 71 and 72. It happened in Aries. That's because Eris moves so slowly. So there is major activity in Aries. This is the social angle of your chart. And the reason that Aries is so, the 11th place, Aries, because you count first house, second house, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, 10, 11. It's like playing backgammon. You have Aries in the 11th place, which describes you as the eminently social being that you are. It's not just that Gemini itself has those characteristics. It's so chatty, and the kids like to talk to each other, and the kids being the twins. And my personal favorite metaphor for Gemini being this thing called the idioglossia, the secret language of twins or babies who are about the same age. It sounds like baby talk gibberish, but actually there is syntax to it. There are twins have actual conversations. Doesn't happen to all twins, but many twins, especially if left alone for a long time, have conversations in a language that no one understands. Usually they forget what it means, but I bet if prompted, I'm sure they feel awkward remembering this, but if prompted, can remember. But Gemini is the sign of the idioglossia that you have with yourself, but it's also... Gemini is also one of the most social signs. The reason why Gemini is one of the most social signs is that Aries, where we all seek self-actualization, is found in the social angle of your chart, House 11. So there's a lot of people in House 11 right now, and there's all kinds of people. We've got Chiron, a centaur planet. We've got Eris, one of the very, very furthest things known. We've got Salacia with an orbit, an elongated orbit near Pluto. We've got Neptune, officially the outermost planet. We've got Saturn, formerly the official most outermost planet. We've got Borsisi, which is about 300-year orbit, 290 or something like that. A whole diversity of things here are making this a very interesting time for you socially. So there's a lot, you have a lot of social freedom, and you've got a real collection of weirdos. And also, there's a social revolution ongoing. The social revolution ongoing involves the influence of the digital environment. And so here's, apart from Uranus and Sedna in your sign, you are experiencing the effects of the digital environment socially more directly than anyone. It's not just that your sense of your self-concept is changing, it's that you really do have your finger on the pulse of the nation when it comes to the types of changes that the digital environment has been influencing and instigating all throughout the 21st century when it has dominated reality. And the double conjunction, the conjunction of Saturn and Neptune, happening at the same time as the conjunction of Chiron and Eris. And by at the same time, I mean within a matter of 6 months, because these things happen so rarely that to happen within 6 months is simultaneously, plus they're very close all at the same time, is to say the environment is changing, but you are aware of how it's changing, and you are in an excellent position to not only change with it, but to be ahead of the curve and to basically see and feel things coming like a kind of a divination, scrying tool. Okay, so this is one aspect pattern, and we've got all of this kind of working together. Now, next thing working together is that Jupiter in June, around June 9th, I believe, Jupiter enters Cancer. This is very, very good for you. It's good in a lot of ways. Now, note that there is an aspect between between Neptune, Saturn, and Jupiter, and also between Neptune, Saturn, and Uranus. This is called an aspect sometimes, the connection between a one sign connection. Nobody can see that. A one sign connection is sometimes called a semi-sextile. But what the one sign connection does is it gets planets and adjoining signs working together. That's a 30-degree aspect called a semi-sextile, and it is generally not used. But what its advantage is that normally what happens between two signs is considered like null and void. There's not really supposed to be any influence. But if you parse out the logic and you think this through, well, it's actually very important to have things working together. But let's end with on that note in terms of the relationship between Jupiter and Uranus. Right now, really, we're looking at these planets making a 90-degree mark to Jupiter. Jupiter, the fastest moving one. Well, this is huge. If you know, Uranus is not a big part of that 99%. So maybe we're down to like, you know, 90% of the mass of the solar system is going to be contained in Jupiter square Saturn Neptune. That's the correct way to say it. Jupiter square Saturn Neptune. And this is a one-off. This is happening in, what's the date of that? It's going to happen probably around June 10th. That's about June 10th. And so the Jupiter retrograde is not quite going to come all the way back. So this is a once in a lifetime gravity assist boost. It is an opportunity, and it is a rare opportunity. So here's what's going on with that. First of all, the second house is the house of money, available cash, but also other resources, including your talent and including the tools of your trade, but more significantly, the value that you hold upon yourself. What is the value that you hold upon yourself? This is a matter of the second house, sometimes called self-esteem, self-respect. And I can say just self-value, the actual, I'm worth more than that. I mean, do you really care about yourself? Right? All of this, I'm so precious, I'm so valuable, it's a bunch of shit. But your demonstrated self-respect is the nature of the second house. And this has, the moon is the ruler of Cancer. The moon is the ruler of Cancer means that anything associated with the sign Cancer is cyclical, very dependably cyclical. For you, this is money being cyclical. So you probably can think of 100 ways in which your financial situation is definitely cyclical, various different feast or famine cycles going on. But what Jupiter is going to do is stabilize your financial situation. And not only stabilize, Jupiter, the greater benefic, brings abundance, and Jupiter is exalted in Cancer. And so we have the exalted ruler of Jupiter, of Cancer, entering the sign Cancer. There is no way to say that this, you can't come up with a bad side to Jupiter and Cancer. There isn't one. And to make it interesting is this is not going to be your average Jupiter in Cancer, because when Jupiter gets there, it's going to be making aspects to Saturn and Neptune. Now, the 11th is also a financial house, but it's the house of the financial benefits of one's career, which is the 10th. It's called the second of the 10th. So that's using derived houses. If we start counting in the 10th, the second of the 10th is the 11th. It is a financial house, and it is very important to you to identify with, okay, I have a career. I'm going to make some money. That's part of the point of a career. Yes, of course, that is absolutely necessary for you and others to feel that you are performing a service of some kind, a valuable service of some kind. Maybe you're not. I doubt you're just in it all for the greed. But when we bring in the second house, this really brings in your priorities into this whole equation. And with Aries in the 11th, the nature of your professional life is about self-actualization. And Cancer is also a very strong sign of self-actualization. So this is like a really big moment of self-actualization for you, but it's not like this private thing going on. Like, you know, you're like, you're high in ayahuasca and you're laying on the ground, somebody's playing the flute and you're like self-actualizing like deep, deep down in there. That's not, I mean, maybe you're going to go on ayahuasca tourism, but that's not what I'm suggesting, nor is it what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that your self-actualization is going to happen in the context of community, and it's going to happen in the context of your ongoing reevaluation of your priorities. Your ongoing reevaluation of your priorities, and that's requiring that you act on your priorities. We see the action piece with the square. The square is, I think, after, you know, now I'm in my fourth decade of doing this. My anniversary of being a public astrologer was May 1st, 1995. After decades of studying the aspects and their energies, the square is unquestionably the most powerful aspect, and this is a very, very powerful square between three of the gas giants, with the fourth one right in the picture. It's like everything is moving in your favor, but you're the one who has to take action. You have to, you know, you move and then Providence moves. So, you know, wait for your moment and make your move when you know to make your move. And, you know, you're largely going to be, I think, carried by this energy. You're going to be, it's going to have a way of like picking you up and putting you down in a new place. And with Uranus in this scenario, you don't really know who you're going to be or where that's going to be, whether we're talking metaphorically or whether we're talking literally. All right. Let's go over a couple of more points here my nose is so itchy. It's so annoying when that happens and I'm on video. All right. Your relationships are described by Sagittarius, and that is a pretty free playing field. Sagittarius wants the ability to roam. It wants the ability to change, the ability to grow, the ability to become. You need room, and you need your space. However, you also are under another influence of Sagittarius, which is that it has Capricorn as its second place. And Capricorn... Sorry about that. Still have actual telephones. Set as Capricorn as its second place. And here's where this gets tricky. As much as Sagittarius wants freedom and envisions relationships that are based on freedom, Capricorn wants to solidify commitment. And this does not work so good all the time. And in our time, it works particularly bad, given the tendency of relationships at the beginning to... let's say, overstate their level of commitment from what would be naturally occurring, and then the inability to sustain that level of commitment based on the speed of the changes of society right now, based on the ways in which people are being thrust into change, deep character change, personality transformations induced by digital technology that they don't understand. So I would say that you want to watch this. And I would say, more than setting a goal of getting into relationships, which most people seem to have this goal of getting involved in the special relationship. They just, you know, they can't help themselves. And there has to be a special relationship in their life. Of course, the number of people for whom this is not working are creating quite a few single people who don't, they're not single in the sense of singles like in the 60s and 1970s where they would hang out waiting to meet people, but rather single in the sense of like going solo, and many are fed up with going solo with relationships. Many are very fed up with going solo, and there's a lot of people who are completely frustrated, particularly, well, the men and women in different ways. The women are finding that their vision for relationships are not being met. They're not really understanding the men, and they're placing huge demands on the men. And then you have many of the men, particularly in their 20s, when they really do need to be exercising their social skills, essentially being isolated or completely absorbed in the digital realm. So there's a lot of solitary relating that is happening. And if we look at what's going on in Capricorn, this will tell us something about how this is expressing itself for you. So the second house of any house brings in the financial aspect. So for example, the second of the first brings in one's personal finances. The second of the 10th brings in the story of the of money coming from the professional activities. The second of the 7th is the 8th, and that brings in money from the outside. But it also does something else, which it brings in values from the outside. And this gets extremely complicated. So the 8th is like this thing where there's all of this incoming, inbound, influxing energy coming in. The 8th is like a hole. It's like an opening in the chart where everything comes flooding in. What do I mean by everything? I mean wills, legacies, trusts, estates, and the marital partner who solidifies in the Capricorn-styled relationship, and all the in-laws, and all the values, and the mishigas of the in-laws, and their cousins. So it's all about the sisters and the cousins and the aunts coming in. Well, the in-laws, sisters, cousins, and aunts coming in the 8th house. And this is a somewhat fraught place right now. Now, if you've been reading my coverage of the Family Hunger Games, we'll link to those two articles, part one and part two. Part two came out last week. There is a massive amount of generational legacy coming in for you here. So we're really talking about more so than the 8th house usually does, the house of in-laws, legacies, wills, trusts, and consummation of the marriage in a contractual form, including the concept of civil death. Ah, well, we're seeing this going back potentially all the way to the beginning. And the beginning is a long time ago. This should be Ixion. That's like an I with an X. If we go back to Quawar, this takes us back to the origins of the tribe. Pholus takes us back four generations. You got a lot of stuff coming in from the past, the distant past. And I would suggest taking some time and really figuring out what this is about. Taking some time and really, really being mindful about all of this influx, inbound energy coming in that is not your own. I think it's probable that at least 90% of the karma that we seem to be carrying is multi-generational ancestral karma, not our own private karma based on our own private actions in previous lifetimes, but rather the inherited legacy of our relatives, of our ancestors, that's all percolating down to us. As said, the sins of the father are passed on to the son, even unto the 7th generation. And so this is a very, very important thing to recognize about reality, is there's a lot of stuff coming down the generations. And with the Family Hunger Games aspect going on, you get to find out what it is. Now, this group here, all concentrated right now at about 12 degrees of Cap, is talking to this point at about 12 degrees of Aries. That is Salacia. And Salacia is your innate sexual self. And what we're getting is an exposition of how the innate sexual self is constantly running up against the friction of the family pattern, the family trauma, the family constellation, and your innate sexual self wants to be absolutely real at all times in your circle of friends. And this is, there's coming out and there's coming out. And your idea of coming out is you want to be absolutely naturally who you are. You are among your friends. You'll know you're among your friends when you can present your innate sexual self to the people around you. Then you know that you are really among friends. Now, opposite this is logos. That's also at about 12 degrees. And so there is a need for a creative conversation. Logos is about, there's a lot of levels on which it works, but one of the ways it works is making sense of things. And in addition to, at other points being here, Hades being one, saying you've got to go deep into your values. Jupiter is about to swing through the territory. This will be happening by early Northern Hemisphere summer. So you're likely to, it's going to light up this entire aspect pattern. And if you're wondering what's going on, why have things gotten so deep so fast, pause and stop and ask yourself, what's the question of your legacy? What is coming in from previous generations? Are you able to express your innate sexual self, Salacia in Aries in the 11th house, in a way that is natural and authentic socially, not having to conceal, not having to give half the story or a third of the story? Finally, is there a real conversation? And is the conversation creative? Is the conversation creative? Fifth house. Is it generative? Does it lead to more? More what? What does it lead to more of? So what you really want is kind of one good conversation leading to another good conversation. And know that as part of the creative process, you're reaching for a truth that you know is there. You know that there is a deeper underlying truth that you can get to. And it's a question of stripping away all these values of other people that are coming in through the eighth. Like, think just, when you see this, and I'll scan this chart for you, and you can make a printout of it. Notice how much is coming in. Well, that's all that is not you. You maybe you're manifesting it, maybe you're attracting it on some level, but that's not you. It is other people. It is their stuff. And so this is more you. This is more who you focus on being, who you choose to be, who you experiment with yourself being socially. And if you're in a kind of a dyadic, pair bonded, I don't really use the word monogamous because so few people are, but dyadic to pair bonded to relationship, and you're experiencing challenges and difficulties, do the homework on what's going on in terms of how are you, even if you go back to your grandparents, what is the story of your grandparents that you're somehow potentially reliving, and does it involve alcohol in any way? That would be Pholus leading the way, the most prominent of these planets. It's the best known, the best developed, the earliest discovered in 1992, is about multi-generational patterns involving alcohol. Okay, so what else? Let's end with some consideration of Pluto. So Pluto made this like agonizing year and a half transition from out of Capricorn, where it was since 2008, out till 2024. It took Pluto from 08 here to 2024 to get here. That's a while. And now, then it entered Aquarius, and it's going to basically leave Aquarius in approximately 2044, so it's going to spend 20 years in Aquarius. This is probably the best position to have Pluto in Aquarius, is the ninth place. Got it in the ninth place. And this puts Pluto where it belongs, which is in a spiritual house. You want to have Pluto in a house associated with spiritual leaning, spiritual activities, spiritual concepts, growth, and all of this. And that's what you've got. And Aquarius is also very, very social. And so you have this benefit of a social, spiritual manifestation of Pluto. And this is Pluto that will work its wonders in a gentle way. And it also places you in the position of being in spiritual leadership. There's no getting around that. I don't mean you're going to be a deacon or a monk or something like that, but you are in a position of spiritual leadership by example in your circle of friends and their friends. So people know who you are, and they're going to look up to you as being a kind of a as Anatoly used to say, Holyman, by which he meant holy man, by which I mean some kind of a, let's say, social shaman. But your goal is not to be shamanic. Your goal is to bring your soul everywhere you go and bond with people on the level of their soul everywhere you go and they go. And that basically is your teaching by example. Okay, so that pretty much wraps up what I've got to say. I will have some astrology afterthoughts as part of the tarot reading, which I'm planning to do in a little while, which is coming next. So there's a tarot card reading associated with this. I brought tarot back into the astrology studio. Now I've got this nifty split-screen camera where I can show you what I'm talking about. Thank you for being a Planet Waves customer. If you're a subscriber, that's very important. That makes sure we can pay the bills throughout the year. You get, I figured it out today, 2,500 hours of my work for a subscription every year. I do 2,500 hours at minimum, and I make it good work, beautiful work, 52 articles, 52 horoscopes, all illustrated with original photography. So thank you for being both a customer and a subscriber to Planet Waves. All right, signing off on Tuesday afternoon, the 20th. I don't think the sun is in Gemini yet, but it's about to be. So signing off on the 20th of May, 2025, from Kingston, New York. I'm Eric Francis, the editor of Planet Waves. Lots of love, and bye for now.